In Auschwitz, I knew what the ashes were. Here, I assumed I knew what the ashes were. It was a building and human remains.
Detective Sergeant Joe Blozes. Maybe I'm exaggerating, but it looked like maybe 18 inches of paper were covering the streets. Just tons and tons of paper from all those office buildings. The paper was catching on fire, which caused our emergency vehicles to catch on fire. We needed equipment before it was burnt up, so we were emptying out the trucks, taking the oxygen out, tools, ropes, and everything.
Dan Potter, I started to see people coming out of wherever they took shelter. I rearranged myself, get myself focused again. I said, that was the South Tower. I'm pretty sure it was the South Tower. Now I said, I gotta get to my wife.
Lila Spessener. As we got further and further away, there were some office buildings. People called us in and said, do you want to wash up? Our phones are working. Do you need to call family? We got t-shirts from some company that had a picnic and had extra t-shirts. Everything we were wearing was soaking wet and dirty.
Lieutenant Joseph Turillo. All the screams around me were turning to cries, and the cries turned into whimpers, and the whimpers turned to silence. I didn't hear anybody else anymore.
Across New York Harbor, in New Jersey, a junior Coast Guard officer, Lieutenant Michael Day, put in motion a massive boat lift to help evacuate people from the tip of Lower Manhattan.
Lieutenant Michael Day, U.S. Coast Guard. We were all in the command center, riveted, because we had these large screen TVs and CNN reports, and when the first tower collapsed, we lost one of the means of communication with the small boats. Our 41-foot utility boats were on their way over there. We lost the radar image after the first tower collapsed because of all the debris. We got reports there were people congregating on the lower tip of Manhattan. That's when it really kicked in, when the first tower collapsed. The havoc.
Rick Schoenlang, President, United New Jersey Sandy Hook Pilots Benevolent Association. There was a call that was put out by the Coast Guard for all boats to render assistance to Lower Manhattan. Our boat, the 184-foot New York, got underway and went steaming full ahead up to the Battery. We sent a number of launches that we had to go up and assist as well.
Lieutenant Michael Day. The marina was filled with firefighters, police officers, rescue workers, and they were jumping onto the boats that were there, all on the sides, and they were getting overloaded again. Firefighters were throwing off their gear and leaping onto the tugs as they were leaving. We probably had 25 to 30 firefighters in the water floundering because this building had come down.
Edward Aswad, Jr. We came across the marina. We got on a boat, or we were trying to get on a boat. My NYPD colleague, Sean, keeps saying he needs water, and I'm rummaging through this boat. There was this silver cabinet like a cooler, and I opened it, and there was water and beer. We start getting bottles of water, and we're pouring it all over our faces, our heads, taking our jackets off.
A few blocks from the World Trade Center, the city's leaders, who had been forced into makeshift command posts because New York's Emergency Management Center in 7 World Trade Center had been damaged, found themselves on the run again following the collapse of the South Tower.
Rudy Giuliani. We walked out into the lobby of 100 Church Street, and within seconds, I had the feeling we had gone from bad to worse. What I saw outside on Church Street was a big cloud going through the street.
Sonny Mindell. Everything was gray. A color world went monochromatic from all the soot and the ash. In this monochromatic world, the first bit of color came in the form of a guy named Tibor Karakas, who was on the mayor's security detail. He came into the building and was completely gray, except for the blood.
Rudy Giuliani. Tibor Karakas was all beaten up, blood coming down his face and looking like he was somewhat in shock. Now, he was a black belt karate in the military. You don't get tougher than Tibor. To see him shook up from pain heightened just how bad this was.
Andrew Kurtzman. A police officer came up to me and said, get off this street. I said, I'm sorry, I'm a journalist, as though this press pass were like a magic device. I said, I've got to find Giuliani. He said, oh, Giuliani is right over there. Sure enough, about 10 feet away from me was Giuliani, surrounded with all of his aides, Bernie Carrick, the police commissioner, Tommy Von Essen, the fire commissioner, Tony Carbonetti, and a whole bunch of his aides. They emerged, and that's when I ran into them.
Rudy Giuliani. I said, okay, we're going out. We'll go up church, and we'll look for a new command center, and we'll make the decision as we're walking along, but let's get out of this building. I grabbed Kurtzman's arm and said, come on, Andrew, you're coming with me.
Andrew Kurtzman. Relations between Giuliani and me had not been particularly warm. In the year preceding that moment, I'd written a book about him called Rudy Giuliani, Emperor of the City. Giuliani vowed never to read it. When he waved me over, suddenly everything changed. He said, we're going to walk north. We've got to get out of here. Because the Office of Emergency Management had been destroyed, City Hall was evacuated. One Police Plaza had lost contact with the world. There was no place for him to take command.
Rudy Giuliani. We started walking north. People started following us, and we kept encouraging people to come with us.
Sonny Mandel. As we travel up Broadway, like a bunch of Pied Pipers, people are gathering with us.
Rudy Giuliani. As we were walking, we were conferring, like, where should we put the command post?
Andrew Kurtzman. It was pretty weird that here was the mayor and the entire leadership of the city, and they were as helpless as anyone walking down the street. As a citizen, it was pretty frightening that no one was in charge, or the person who was supposed to be in charge had no way of operating.
Sonny Mandel. I remember coming upon one older woman who was seated in a park. She was drinking a Starbucks. She wasn't moving. She was sitting there drinking her coffee. I didn't want to frighten her, but I thought, she needs to get out of here. I went up to her and I said, ma'am, you need to go north. And she says, no, I'm fine here. I said, you really have to get out of here. But she wasn't frightened. I think she maybe had that same reaction I had when I looked at the TV and went, this is not my life. This is something I'm watching.
Having just survived the collapse of the South Tower, siblings John and Michelle Cartier formulated a plan to escape the devastation of Lower Manhattan, even as they worried about their brother James, not knowing whether he too had escaped.
John Cartier. We made it not that far and went into a deli. Deli owner was like, take everything, take water, take whatever you want.
Michelle Cartier. At that point, John had his water, I grabbed mine, and I remember grabbing one for my brother James and throwing it into the briefcase I had. We started talking about John's motorcycle and where it was and how far away.
John Cartier. I walked back towards my bike. It was on the sidewalk, completely covered in soot. I was like, I hope this damn thing starts. Please, God, start. It fired right up. I pulled up, Michelle got on the bike, and we slowly left. People were taking pictures of us covered in the soot, leaving.
Michelle Cartier. I'm in this blue skirt and on my brother's motorcycle. I was completely disoriented. I had no idea which way we were going.
John Cartier. We only had one goal. Make it home. She kept on asking me about James. I said, he probably got out on the west side. That's what I thought.
Michelle Cartier. Then he said, just pray. Just pray.
You were hoping you would find something. The rescue at Shanksville. Just like their colleagues in New York and Washington, the first responders and officials around Shanksville were forced to improvise a response to a worst-case scenario.
James Clark, First Assistant Chief, Somerset Volunteer Fire Department. It was 10 o'clock or so when our pagers tripped for our large aircraft down.
Alan Baumgartner, Somerset County 911 Coordinator. It seemed like immediately every phone line in the center was lit up. Everybody grabbed for a phone and they were all the same call. A plane has gone down out near Lambertsville.
Rick King, Assistant Chief, Shanksville Volunteer Fire Company. I got into the station. I remember the dispatcher saying, a plane down, Lambertsville Road, Lambertsville area. I asked who was dispatched with us, and they said, your station, Freedon's in Stoystown. I knew County 911 thought it was a small plane, so I said, County, I heard this plane crash. I'm convinced it was a commercial airliner. I said, I want additional departments. I called for Central City, Somerset, Listy, Berlin, and I called for Somerset's hazmat unit. They started to dispatch those.
Sergeant Patrick Madigan. We all packed up and headed to Shanksville.
Rick King. Keith Custer was sitting beside me in the officer's seat. Keith said, I can't swallow. My mouth is dry. Mine was too. It sucked everything out of me. We've been in situations where we've been on terrible car accidents and things like that. This was different. I knew that somehow this was related to what was going on.
Keith Custer, firefighter, Shanksville Volunteer Fire Company. It was total silence in that truck the whole way out there. I don't think we said but five words to each other.
Rick King. We had a cell phone in the engine at the time, and I got on the cell phone, being afraid for what was happening to our country, and I called my wife and I said, go get our kids out of school. I don't know what's happening. I was thinking planes were now somehow going to be indiscriminately falling out of the sky. I said, while you're there, you might want to tell the school to close early.
Kevin Husek, paramedic, Somerset Area Ambulance Association. We got a short ways down from our station on Route 30, looked over to the horizon, and saw a big, large cloud of black smoke. We advised our dispatch center to dispatch every ambulance that had two or more ambulances in their station in Somerset and Cambria County.
The first to reach the crash scene in Shanksville were local neighbors who witnessed the crash, workers from a nearby salvage yard, and two coal truck drivers. Not long after, volunteer firefighters began to arrive. Then, within hours, state and federal officials and scores of reporters would descend on the former mine site en masse, setting up a temporary town that would exist for months as investigators sifted and searched through the wreckage. The crash site of Flight 93 perplexed many of those responding, as the soft earth of the former mine swallowed up the wreckage and buried much of the plane in the ground.
Douglas Miller, coal truck driver, James F. Barron Trucking. We turned in and then immediately made a right, which took us to the crash scene within 30 yards. There was nobody else there at the time.
Robert Bobby Blair, truck driver, James F. Barron Trucking. The trees were on fire.
Douglas Miller. The heat, I assumed it was from the jet fuel, was so intense, I had to remark to Bob, hey, we better back up, because I thought it would blister the paint on my hood. You could feel the heat through the windows.
Robert Bobby Blair. We had taken our fire extinguishers and we knocked the fire out that was blowing across the field pretty quick. It was a large tire laying there right at the hole. It was still burning. We both tried to knock it out, but then as soon as you quit spraying, it started back up again.
Eric Peterson, resident, Stony Creek Township. When I got up there, there was actually still pieces of mail and stuff like that falling from the sky.
Douglas Miller. There wasn't anything to tell you that it was a plane when you first looked. It looked like maybe a truck delivering mail or maybe something carrying a lot of paperwork might have wrecked. There was paperwork, letters and envelopes scattered everywhere.
Kevin Husek. Shanksville Fire Department's engine was actually arriving at the same time that we were. We went back first, their engine followed, and I believe a unit from Stoystown Fire Department was right behind them.
Merle Flick, firefighter, Shanksville Volunteer Fire Company. It wasn't too much to see.
James Broderick, trooper, Pennsylvania State Police. I remember opening the car door and going to step out. I happened to look down and there was a piece of a human body, a bone or a joint. I knew no one could have survived that crash, seeing that small of a piece. I got back in the car. I knew that I had pulled too close. I backed up.
Ralph Blancy, Fire Chief, Storystown Volunteer Fire Company. Trooper Broderick and I were standing next to the crater, and one of my firemen came up and said, "Are you in charge here?" Which is protocol for fire companies. Rick King of the Shanksville Fire Department said, "I'm in charge." Before he got that out of his mouth, Trooper Broderick says, "I'm in charge. This is a crime scene." That settled everything real quick.
James Broderick. I knew that we had to secure the scene, keep people out, because people were starting to pick things up.
Rick King. People are coming to me and saying, "What do we do? What do you want us to do?" There wasn't anything to do.
Norbert Rosenbaum, firefighter, Stoystown Volunteer Fire Company. They said, "Go on to a search and rescue." When I saw the parts and everything, I said, "I don't think you're going to be rescuing nobody. It's too big a hole." I did see a lot of stuff that I'd seen before. I was in Vietnam. There was just parts of human pieces. That's all it was. Pieces.
James Broderick. I remember the smell. Once you smell diesel fuel mixed with the human body, you'll never forget that smell.
Lieutenant Robert Weaver, Pennsylvania State Police. That was the first thing that hit me. The smell.
Michael Rosenbaum, firefighter, Stoystown Volunteer Fire Company. Something was smelling really sweet. I didn't know what it was, and I thought it was a flower or something that was in the woods. It had a sweet smell to it. I had asked my dad several times, and he wouldn't tell me. Later that day, one of the other firemen told me what it was.
Sergeant Denise Miller, Indian Lake Police Department. I thought, this is what hell must look like. The ground was smoking and smoldering.
Keith Custer. We did a little sweep around, and it was probably 10, 15 minutes before we realized there would be no survivors.
Cynthia Daniels, EMT, Somerset Area Ambulance Association. Kevin Huzik radioed the Somerset manager, Jill Miller, and Jill told him that we might as well go back to the ambulance hall and regroup. There was really nothing we could do. There was nothing. No one to take care of.
Kevin Huzik. The conversation was very bleak.
Tim Lensbauer, crane operator, Rollock Incorporated. We hollered all the way down through the woods, and there was nothing there. Just the pine trees burning. We searched and searched. We ran and ran. There was nothing other than paper. One of us found a book bag, a little kid's book bag.
Corporal Louis Feetz, Collision Reconstruction Specialist, Pennsylvania State Police. We actually found money that was still intact. I can remember finding pocketbooks with family pictures in it, clothing, someone's shoe.
Sergeant Craig Bowman, Crime Investigation Unit, Pennsylvania State Police. An open Bible was laying there. Considering the condition of all the other debris, it was relatively unscathed.
T. Michael Laufer, Trooper, Pennsylvania State Police. I actually found a flight book from one of the flight attendants laying down there, down in the hemlocks. That's when I knew it was a United flight, because it had United Airlines printed on it. Bradshaw was the name in it.
James Broderick. I remember it was flight attendant Sandra Bradshaw. It had a picture of her and her family. I had taken that with me because we started to take things back and place them on the back of a fire truck. Things were starting to blow away or burn. We wanted to protect everything that we could that could be possible evidence or things that could possibly be returned to the family members.
Clyde Ware, Assistant Chief, Stoystown Volunteer Fire Company. You kept looking and hoping for the impossible that day.
Lieutenant Robert Weaver. We were talking and I said, "I can't believe this is a commercial plane." Within minutes, FBI agent Wells Morrison got a phone call and confirmed it was Flight 93. He said, "Yes, it's confirmed. This is Flight 93.
Keith Custer. Then we put it all together. Hey, this is the fourth plane.
Paula Pluta, resident, Stony Creek Township. I started thinking, what in the world do they want with Shanksville, Pennsylvania?
There's nothing here.
Sergeant Denise Miller, when I first got out there to the site, I was actually a little nervous. I wondered what the importance of the field was and what possibly the government had hidden under the ground there that they wanted. I couldn't figure out why the plane had come down here.
Wells Morrison, Supervisory Special Agent, FBI. What became the priority now was to preserve the crash site and attempt to obtain anything of evidentiary value.
Not long after Flight 93 crashed, the first media arrived at the scene and began to confirm for the world that another attack had occurred, ending in a field near Shanksville.
Lawrence Kesterson, staff photographer, Philadelphia Inquirer. All we had was, there's a plane that crashed in western Pennsylvania. Go. My boss said, just go, just get on the turnpike and go west. We'll call as we know more.
Peter M. Mike Drewecki, photographer, WPXI-TV, Pittsburgh. We were trying to pinpoint exactly where Shanksville was, because I had never heard of it before.
David Mattingly, national correspondent, CNN. This was in the days before everyone had a GPS in their car, so I still had to get there the old-fashioned way. I had to stop and buy a map.
Corporal Jeffrey Braid, Aviation Patrol Unit, Pennsylvania State Police. It was eerily quiet on the radios for the airplanes. The whole ride out to Shanksville, there was really no communication between airplanes and ground.
Tony James, investigator, FAA. I drove to the FAA's Hangar 6 in Washington, which is located at Ronald Reagan Airport, and I put my stuff on the airplane. It was myself, two NTSB, National Transportation Safety Board, people, and the two pilots. We were the only airplane in the air. We were talking to air traffic control, and they said, you're cleared direct. Go as fast and as high as you want to go.
Corporal Jeffrey Braid. We were 5 miles out, and we still didn't see anything, so we started contacting the ground units and said, are these the right coordinates? We still didn't see any smoke or debris. We got almost right on top of it, and then we started seeing the cars and stuff.
Tony James. We get up here and we could see the woods burning, and we made a couple of low flybys, which got a lot of people's attention.
Braden Schober, firefighter, Shanksville Volunteer Fire Company. Keith Custer pointed up to the sky and said, that's not supposed to be there. We looked, and there was a large plane flying toward us. At this point, we all know that there aren't supposed to be any planes in the sky because the FAA's put everybody on the ground. It was a little eerie. You started looking around. Where are we going to hide?
Keith Custer, what do you do to get away from a plane that's coming at you? Do you try to outrun it? It's coming at you so fast.
Captain Frank Monaco, Pennsylvania State Police. There was a giant jetliner right over our heads. It was like a Twilight Zone episode. Everybody was frozen in their tracks. Nobody was moving. Nobody was talking. Everybody was stunned. Is it another one?
Keith Custer. When it went by us, everybody kind of did a wow.
Peter M. Mike Drewecki. There was a gathering of workers standing in front of Highland Tank Company. Some were smoking cigarettes, some were standing around, scratching their heads. They knew why we were there, and they just pointed their thumbs over their shoulders and said, whatever it is you're looking for, it's up that way.
John Meyer, reporter WNEP-TV, Scranton, Pennsylvania. The next thing I knew, I was right where the crater was. It was an overwhelming experience. The only way I knew it was a plane was the size. It was a big crater.
Peter M. Mike Drewecki. I was met by a photographer from the Greensburg, Pennsylvania Tribune Review by the name of Sean Stipp. It's strange. You're not looking at each other, but you're looking at the things you have to shoot. I remember saying, Sean, this is the beginning of World War III.
David Mattingly. The first live report I did was over the telephone. I was explaining where I was, this bucolic setting, this pasture on the right, this cornfield on the left, these rolling hills around me, this blue sky above me. It seemed a highly, highly improbable location to be doing a story about what appeared to be some terrorist attack.
As word spread of the fourth crash, the families of victims aboard Flight 93 learned that their greatest fears had been realized.
Alice Ann Hoagland, mother of United Flight 93 passenger Mark Bingham. We heard the news that Flight 93 had crashed in Pennsylvania. They had the footage on television so fast, and it showed rescue workers already on the site, with a big, gaping, smoldering hole. That's the way I found out Mark had been killed.
Dina Burnett. I realized I'd been running around the house all morning in my pajamas. I needed to get dressed. I went upstairs. I had the telephone with me. I put it on the ledge by the shower so that in the event I didn't hear it, I could see it ring. I never took my eyes off the telephone while I was showering. I got dressed and went downstairs. The policeman was standing at the bottom of the stairs, and I could tell by the look on his face that something was wrong. He said, "I think I have bad news for you." I remember turning toward the television and seeing that there had been another plane crash. I ran over to the TV and I asked, "Is that Tom's plane?" He said, "Yes, it's Flight 93. I felt my knees buckle.
Lisbeth Glick. They told me that Jeremy's plane had gone down. The police were at my house, and somebody said there had been some survivors on the plane. I thought, okay, if there are survivors, he's going to be one of them because he's a survivor. My minister came over, and we sat there and prayed. I knew since there was no call, it wasn't good news. United probably called 3 hours after the plane went down. I said, you don't even need to tell me. I know."
That very slow, quiet panic. At school in Arlington, Virginia. Since the attacks happened in the morning, teachers all around the East Coast were faced with a decision they had not been trained to make: how to talk to their students about the tragedies happening in New York and Washington, D.C. One of the schools that faced this dilemma most profoundly was in the Pentagon's hometown, just a few miles from the crash site. H.B. Woodlawn school officials tried to calm their 600 students, many of whom had family members working at the Pentagon, the Capitol, the White House, or other government offices, as panicked parents began to arrive to take them home.
Ray Anderson, principal, H.B. Woodlawn School, Arlington. At about 9 o'clock, kids started coming into the office who had gotten off the bus. They were wearing Walkmans and listening to the radio, and they're talking about terrible things happening in New York City.
Frank Altewanger, assistant principal, H.B. Woodlawn School. Sometime during the first period, the second tower was hit.
Ray Anderson, we had to adjust to this unbelievable thing. You had no frame of reference for it, and quickly realized that this was going to be a real problem for students being in high school. I got on the PA and I told everyone, told the teachers to turn off all the TVs. People didn't need to sit around all morning and watch these horrible events.
Teresa Flynn, librarian, H.B. Woodlawn School. My phone rang and it was my mother. She had heard an explosion at the Pentagon and ran out her front door. She said, "We're in trouble. You need to get home."
Frank Altewanger. When the Pentagon was hit, that changed everything, because we had a number of kids who have parents who worked there.
Ray Anderson. The phone system quickly became inoperative, and cell phones became inoperative. Everybody was trying to use the phones at the same time.
Teresa Flynn. People stopped teaching. They didn't know what to do. About a third of our staff and students had family members who were at the Pentagon who were working downtown. The news was not helpful. They started saying, "Car bomb at the State Department. There's another plane in the air. We don't know how many planes are in the air. They're all heading toward D.C. Everybody was panicking, but it was that very slow, quiet panic.
Frank Altewanger. We were able to maintain reasonable order downstairs by keeping the kids in the classrooms. There were two or three students who either had parents at the Pentagon or parents who were in the air to New York who became hysterical and were running down the hall. I had some come into my office. I found another teacher who was a good counselor and had that teacher sit with them.
Ray Anderson, parents started showing up at school wanting their children.
Frank Altewenger, I'd say 50 or 70 parents came. Most of them came, checked on their child, and left.
Ray Anderson, I got on the PA, now it's probably about 10:15, 10:30 at the latest, and said without being any more specific, we may need to do our tornado drill today. I reminded people the tornado drill is not the fire drill where we all go outside and get away from the building. The tornado drill is when we all go down to the basement and first floor hallways.
Mary McBride, assistant principal, H.B. Woodlawn School. Mercifully, those parents working at the Pentagon were all right. That was the most important piece of almost the whole day for us, because that didn't happen for one of our principals.
Ray Anderson, the husband of the principal at Hoffman Boston Elementary in Arlington, was on the plane that hit the Pentagon. It flew right over her building. She had some notion that that might be the case, but she stayed at her post as principal of the school, doing what I was doing at my school until the day was over. Then at the end of the day, she found out her notion was correct.
Teresa Flynn, we had in the library 100, 150 people standing there. We had a television at either end of the library. There's not a sound other than the news. The news anchors were beginning to spout theories about Osama bin Laden. A young boy, he was in ninth grade at the time, he turned to me and said, "Why did they do this to us?" Which was a big question from the kids. I said, "Well, they don't like us very much." He said, "Why not?"
We have no place to go. Aboard Air Force One, somewhere over the Gulf of Mexico. Whisked aboard Air Force One minutes after the Pentagon attack, President George W. Bush and his entourage tried to understand the carnage below and figure out where they could go themselves. When President Bush and Vice President Cheney finally connected by phone, they discussed the day's most momentous order, authorizing fighters to down hijacked aircraft. It remains unclear whether that conversation took place before Vice President Cheney issued his shoot-down order in the PEOC. The custom Boeing 747 that served that day as Air Force One contained the president's private cabin and office, known as the Airborne Oval Office, at the front of the plane on the main deck. From there, stairs led up to the flight deck and communications suite. Other cabins toward the rear of the aircraft on the main deck housed the White House medical unit, staff, guests, security, the press, and crew. Isolated far above the earth, their communication networks disrupted, the passengers and crew tried to figure out what had transpired on the ground and existed in a time frame all their own.
Dave Wilkinson, Assistant Agent in Charge, U.S. Secret Service. Once we heard a plane had crashed into the Pentagon, that's when we said, we're not going back to Washington. It's all about that direction of interest. At the start, the threats in New York. Then the plane hit the Pentagon, and it's about our seats of government.
Colonel Mark Tillman, Presidential Pilot, Air Force One. The initial conversation was that we'd take him to an Air Force base no less than an hour away from Washington. Maybe we'd try to get him to Camp David. That all changed when we heard there was a plane headed towards Camp David. I made the takeoff, climbed out, probably 25 to 30,000 feet, and I gave it up to the backup pilot. I had three pilots on board that day. I said to keep flying towards Washington, D.C.
Initial reports of Flight 93 were garbled, claiming that Camp David, the presidential retreat along the Maryland-Pennsylvania border, had been targeted.
Major General Larry Arnold. We were talking to the Secret Service, and they were on again, off again about whether they wanted us to follow him. There was an AWACS, airborne surveillance aircraft, off the East Coast during a training mission. So we diverted that aircraft towards Sarasota to pick up the president when he took off. They said, okay, we will follow the president. Where is he going? We said, we don't know.
Ari Fleischer, Press Secretary, White House. As we were flying out of Sarasota, we were able to get some TV reception. They broke for commercial. I couldn't believe it. A hair loss commercial comes on. I remember thinking, in the middle of all this, I'm watching this commercial for hair loss?
Andy Card, Chief of Staff, White House. Blake Gottesman was my personal aide, but he was filling in that day as the president's aide. I said, Blake, it's your job to make sure that people don't come up to the suite. No one comes up unless the president calls for them.
Carl Rove. Andy Card and I were with the president. He got a call from Cheney. He said yes. Then there was a pause as he listened. Then another yes. You had an unreal sense of time that whole day. I don't know whether it was 10 seconds or 2 minutes. Then he said, you have my authorization. Then he listened for a while longer. He closed off the conversation. He turned to us and said that he had just authorized the shoot down of hijacked airliners.
Andy Card. As soon as he hung up the phone, he said, I was an Air National Guard pilot. I'd be one of the people getting this order. I can't imagine getting this order.
Dave Wilkinson. Every kind of communication that day was challenged. Even the president talking to the Situation Room was challenged.
Master Sergeant Dana Lark. People were coming up to the communications deck with various requests. A Secret Service agent comes up and says, the president wants to know the status of the first family. I have to tell him I don't have a way to find out. I can't fathom what that was like for the president.
Carl Rove. He was so even-handed. He was so naturally calm during the day.
Master Sergeant Dana Lark. We've got multiple systems, commercial and terrestrial systems, and they're all jammed. I started to have tunnel vision. What the hell is going on? Did someone sabotage our comms? It wasn't until later I realized all the commercial systems were all saturated. It was all the same systems the airplane pilots were using at the same time talking to their dispatchers.
Colonel Mark Tillman. We started having to use the military satellites, which we would only use in the time of war.
Andy Card. One of the president's first thoughts from Sarasota to Barksdale, Air Force Base in Louisiana, was Vladimir Putin, president of Russia.
Ari Fleischer. Putin was fantastic that day. He was a different Vladimir Putin in 2001. America could have had no better ally on September 11th than Russia and Putin.
Gordon Jandro. Putin was important. All these military systems were put in place for nuclear alerts. If we went on alert, we needed Putin to know that we weren't readying an attack on Russia. He was great. He said immediately that Russia wouldn't respond.
Ari Fleischer. I've never heard the word decapitation attack before, but people like Andy, who had been there during the Cold War and had the training, knew what was going on. The Secret Service said to the president, "We don't think it's safe for you to return to Washington."
Andy Card. Then we hear that Flight 93's gone down. We're all wondering, did we do that?
Colonel Mark Tillman. All of us, we assumed we shot it down.
Dave Wilkinson. Hearing all of this, we're thinking that the further we're away from Washington, the safer we are.
Colonel Mark Tillman. We get this report that there's a call saying Angel was next. No one really knows now where the comment came from. It got mistranslated or garbled between the White House, the Situation Room, and the radio operators. Angel was our code name, but the fact that they knew about Angel, well, you had to be in the inner circle. That was a big deal to me. It was time to hunker down and get some good weaponry.
Major Scott Hooter Krog, F-16 pilot, 111th Fighter Squadron, Houston. I'd just gotten off alert at Ellington Field in Houston. Normally, we pull 24-hour alerts, mostly for drug interdiction. I'd just gotten back into bed and was watching TV and saw the reports of a plane hitting the tower. When that second plane hit, it eliminated any doubt. I had to get back to work. It was very somber at the airbase. We got these cryptic messages from Southeast Air Defense Sector. I asked maintenance to put live missiles on the fighters and arm up the guns. Two heat-seeking missiles and rounds from a 20-millimeter gun isn't a lot to take on a hijacked plane, but it was the best we could do. We dispatched 2 fighters to go protect Air Force One.
Colonel Mark Tillman, we put a cop at the base of the stairs leading to the cockpit. That was something we'd never done before.
Staff Sergeant William Buzz Buzinski, Security, Air Force One. Will Chandler, the lead Air Force security officer, was summoned to the front, and he stayed up there providing security at the cockpit stairs. That got us thinking, is there an insider threat?
Staff Sergeant Paul Germain. Colonel Tillman said at that point, let's go cruise around the Gulf for a little bit. This was our Pearl Harbor. You trained for nuclear war, but then you get into something like this. All the money they pumped into us for training, that worked.
Dave Wilkinson. Colonel Tillman took us to a height where, if an aircraft was coming toward us, we'd know it was no mistake. I was confident we were safer in the air than we were anywhere on the ground.
Colonel Mark Tillman, I took us up to 45,000 feet. That's about as high as a 747 can go.
Ann Compton, reporter, ABC News. We were standing in the press cabin. A Secret Service agent was in the aisle, and he pointed at the monitor and said, look down there, Ann. We're at 45,000 feet, and we have no place to go.
Condoleezza Rice. I called the president, and he said, I'm coming back. I said, you stay where you are. You cannot come back here. Washington is under attack.
Karl Rove. There was acrimony. President Bush doesn't raise his voice. He doesn't pound the desk. But as we made it across the Florida Peninsula, Andy Card and presidential military aide Tom Gould kept raising objections about returning to Washington. At one point, Cheney and Rumsfeld called and said the same thing.
Dave Wilkinson. He fought with us tooth and nail all day to go back to Washington. We basically refused to take him back. The way we look at it is that by federal law, the Secret Service has to protect the president. The wishes of that person that day are secondary to what the law expects of us. Theoretically, it's not his call, it's our call.
Eric Draper, presidential photographer. He was visibly frustrated and very angry. I was a few feet away, and it felt like he was looking through me. He turned away in anger.
Karl Rove. Gould came in and said, Mr. President, we don't have a full fuel load. We've got too many extraneous people on board. We can't loiter over Washington if we need to. He suggested, let's get to a military base, drop off the unessential personnel, fill up with fuel, and reassess.
Sonia Ross. We didn't know where we were going, but they must have been circling, because we kept watching the local feed of a Florida station going in and out. That was our tiny window into the outside world.
Ari Fleischer. We didn't have satellite TV on the plane. The news would frustratingly come in and go out. I was not aware of the punishing coverage that the president was receiving for not returning to Washington. The anchors were all asking, where's Bush? They instantly criticized him.
Karen Hughes, Communications Director, White House. Since I was home, I saw quite a bit of TV coverage, just like the American people were seeing it. And I realized that it looked like the American government was faltering. I was on the phone with my chief of staff at the White House when she was told to evacuate. I could actually see the Pentagon burning. But I knew that lots of government was functioning. Planes were being grounded. Emergency plans were being implemented. I thought someone should be telling the American people that, so I wanted to talk to the president. When I called the operator to try to reach Air Force One, the operator came back on the line and said, "Ma'am, we can't reach Air Force One." Mary Madeline had passed along that there was a threat against the plane. It was chilling. For a split second, I was so worried.
Sonia Ross. Ann Compton of ABC News and I were trying to come up with timelines. What time was it when Andy Card came in and whispered to the president? We were listening through headsets to the television, but we weren't really paying attention. Then I heard the reporter say, "The tower's collapsing." I looked at the TV and had a completely shocked reaction.
Eric Draper. We were in the president's office when the towers fell. You knew that there'd be a loss of life in a catastrophic way. The room was really silent. Everyone peeled off one by one, and the president stood there, alone, watching the cloud expand.
Andy Card. I asked the military aides, where are we going? I want options. I want a long runway, a secure place, good communications. They came back and said Barksdale Air Force Base. I said, don't tell anyone we're coming.
Dave Wilkinson. It was the perfect compromise. Close and secure, and we could let off a lot of passengers there. We needed somewhere that had armored vehicles.
Andy Card. I went into the president's cabin and told him, we're going to Barksdale. He said, no, we're going back to the White House. He was pretty hot with me. I kept saying, I don't think you want to make that decision right now. He went back and forth. It wasn't one conversation. It was 5, 6, 7 conversations.
Colonel Mark Tillman, we asked for fighter support. We heard you have fast movers at your 7 o'clock. There were supersonic F-16s from the President's Guard Unit. They led us into Barksdale.
Major Scott Hooter Krog. The horn went off again in Ellington Field in Houston, and F-16 pilot Shane Brotherton and I launched. We didn't even know what the mission was. We were told, you need to intercept the Angel Flight. We had no idea what that meant. We never heard Air Force One call that before.
Representative Adam Putnam aboard Air Force One. Representative Dan Miller and I went up to the president's cabin and he gave us a briefing. He told us that one way or another, all but a couple planes were accounted for. That was his phrase, one way or another. He told us Air Force One was headed to Barksdale and was going to drop us off there. When he left the cabin, I turned to Dan and said, didn't you think that was an odd phrase? He didn't notice it. I said, one way or another. That sounds like there's more to it than that. I said, do you think there's any way we shot them down? We were left hanging.
Gordon Jandro. I was sitting across the table from CIA presidential briefer Mike Morrell in the staff cabin. I asked, Mike, is something else going to happen? He said, yes. That was a real gut punch.
Brian Montgomery, Director of Advance, White House. I asked Mike Morrell who he thought this was. He said, UBL. No hesitation. Who's UBL? Those of us not up on the lingo of Langley, we had no idea.
Mike Morrell, Presidential Briefer, Central Intelligence Agency. The president called me into his cabin. It was packed with people. The Democratic Front for the Liberation of Palestine had issued a claim of responsibility for the attack. The president asked me, what do you know about these guys? I explained that they had a long history of terrorism, but they didn't have the capability to do this, guaranteed. As I was leaving, he said to me, Michael, one more thing. Call CIA Director George Tenet and tell him that if he finds out anything about who did it, I want to be the first to know. Got that?
Sonia Ross. I was nervous. I was thinking, it seems really morbid, but I was thinking, what if they come after the president? We all turn into and 12 others. No one knows your name if you go down with the president. But Eric Washington, he was the CBS sound guy. He had his seat reclined, his feet up. He said, what are you worried about? You're on the safest plane in the world.
Gordon Jandro. Air Force One was the safest and most dangerous place in the world at the exact same time.
Karen Hughes. When I finally did reach Air Force One and spoke with the president, the first thing he said to me was, don't you think I need to come back? He was chomping at the bit to come back. I told him yes, as soon as you can. Everyone has different roles, and I wasn't thinking about the national security side. I was thinking about it from a PR perspective.
Andy Card. Mark Tillman said, I don't care what he says. I'm in charge of the plane.
Dave Wilkinson. The president once told me that the biggest piece of advice he'd got from his mother when he became president was always to do what the Secret Service says. I reminded him of that several times that day. The president and I knew each other very well. We'd spent a lot of hours at his ranch, and tongue-in-cheek several times that day I said, remember what your mother said.
Master Sergeant Dana Lark. There were so many people coming up to the upper deck because we weren't picking up the phones downstairs. It got too crowded. Finally, someone came up and told everyone to get out. The only member of the staff who was up with us was White House Staff Secretary Harriet Myers. She was sitting at one of the CSO seats with a legal pad taking down the historical record.
Andy Card. The president's wondering about his wife, his kids, his parents. Then he's wondering, is there another city? What's next? We're all thinking, we can't do anything about it. We're in a plane, 8 miles high in the sky.
Dave Wilkinson. We called Mark Rosenker, the director of the White House military office, up to the front of the plane and told him to get us on the phone with the commander at Barksdale. He gave us full assurance that the base would be locked down.
Andy Card. I was comforted to find Barksdale was already on alert. It was going to be secure. No random terrorist would have mapped that Barksdale was where the president was going to go.
Lieutenant General Tom Keck, commander, Barksdale Air Force Base. We were already in a practice threat con delta, the highest threat condition. I said, lock her down for real. My deputy told me that at threat con delta, general officers have to wear sidearms. I tried to refuse, but he insisted. So I was wearing my sidearm, which I never do. We got this radio request, Code Alpha, a high-priority incoming aircraft. It wanted 150,000 pounds of gas, 40 gallons of coffee, 70 box lunches, and 25 pounds of bananas. It wouldn't identify itself. It was clearly a big plane. It didn't take us long to figure out that the Code Alpha was Air Force One.
Ann Compton. As we were landing, going into Barksdale, Ari came back to the press cabin and said, "This is off the record, but the president is being evacuated." I said, "You can't put that off the record. That's a historic and chilling fact. That has to be on the record."
Bin Laden comes to mind. Among those who knew. While the country absorbed the news and horror of the terrorist attacks in Washington, New York, and Pennsylvania, TV anchors and reporters turned to experts who could explain the attacks, which to most Americans seemed to come out of nowhere. Few Americans knew the name Osama bin Laden. Midday on 9/11, Washington NBC4 TV anchors brought into their studio a man who knew the background of the attacks.
We want to turn now to a guest who is joining us in the studio. It's Paul Bremer. I want to make sure I'm getting your name right because I'm just meeting you. You're a terrorism expert?
Counterterrorism, I hope.
And can you talk to us a little bit about who could... I mean, there are a limited number of groups who could be responsible for something of this magnitude, right?
Yes. This is a very well planned, very well coordinated attack, which suggests it's very well organized centrally. And there are only three or four candidates in the world, really, who could have conducted this attack.
Bin Laden comes to mind right away, Mr. Bremer.
Indeed, he certainly does.
Since the mid-1990s, two squads of the FBI's Joint Terrorism Task Force in New York, known as I-49 and I-45, had been carefully tracking the rise of a terrorist group known as Al-Qaeda. Even though his name was new to most Americans on September 11th, the organization's leader, Osama bin Laden, had been on the FBI's radar for some time, having been added to its 10 most wanted list in June 1999 for his role in planning and financing the 1998 U.S. embassy bombings in Kenya and Tanzania. In 1999, careful work by law enforcement intercepted an Al-Qaeda plan to attack the United States during the Millennium celebrations. And in 2000, Al-Qaeda terrorists attacked the USS Cole in Yemen, killing 17 U.S. sailors. The State Department's Ambassador-at-Large for Counterterrorism, Michael Sheehan, spoke angrily to military officials in 2000, frustrated at the Clinton administration's lack of focus in combating the rise of bin Laden's terrorist group, presciently exclaiming, "Does Al-Qaeda have to hit the Pentagon to get your attention?" By 2001, FBI agents from I-45 and I-49 were chasing bin Laden's group around the world. That Tuesday morning found a team of agents still in Aden, Yemen, investigating the Cole bombing, and another team of agents in Scandinavia, where on Monday night, September 10th, they'd raided a house hoping to catch one of the embassy bombers. In Washington on September 11th, at 8 a.m. Eastern Time, FBI counterterrorism agents had briefed the new FBI director, Robert Mueller, who had started on September 4th, on the status of the al-Qaeda investigation and the Cole bombing. The 9/11 attack on the World Trade Center hit just blocks from the FBI squad's offices at 290 Broadway, a few blocks from the FBI's main office at 26 Federal Plaza, and pulled many of those same agents who had long tracked bin Laden out into the debris-filled streets, catching them in the tower's collapse. Ironically, the attacks would ultimately kill veteran FBI agent John O'Neill, who had led the al-Qaeda task force and who had retired in August from the Bureau to start a new job as the security director at the World Trade Center.
John Antisev, Special Agent, FBI Joint Terrorism Task Force. People on the ground get to see the future before everyone. I think NYPD Detective Lou Napoli and I were the first people to write UBL into Bureau files in the early 1990s. You knew this Afghan movement was more than fighting Russians. We just didn't know to call it al-Qaeda.
Robert Bear Bryant, Deputy Director, FBI, 1997 to 99. The first time I ever heard the name Osama bin Laden was from John O'Neill. John O'Neill was very much aware of who he was, who his group was, al-Qaeda.
John Miller, correspondent, ABC News. In 1998, I sat with Osama bin Laden in a hut in Afghanistan as he told me he was declaring war on America. We are sure of victory. Our battle with the Americans is larger than our battle with the Russians. We predict a black day for America and the end of the United States. From the moment bin Laden declared war on America, one of his frustrations seemed to be that he couldn't get America to declare war back.
Jackie McGuire, Special Agent, FBI Joint Terrorism Task Force. The JTTF's very famous for the work it has done on the first World Trade Center bombing in 1993. It also sent people all over the world. The East Africa Embassy bombing case was run out of New York. The USS Cole bombing was run out of New York.
Fran Townsend, Director, Office of Intelligence, Policy, and Review, U.S. Justice Department. From his time down in the International Terrorism Section at headquarters in Washington, John O'Neill began to see the World Trade Center bomber Ramzi Youssef case. As things progressed, John completely threw himself into it. He read everything he could get his hands on about radical fundamentalism. He was already beginning to focus on it before the first World Trade Center, and think about it, and look at the implications of it. By the time the first bombing happens, from things he said to me, he already got in his mind this was a major and long-term problem for us that we were ill-equipped to deal with.
Steve Gordon, Special Agent, FBI Joint Terrorism Task Force. It was hard to get people to pay attention. That spring, we'd put four of the embassy bombers on trial. I remember Puff Daddy was on trial in municipal court and Johnny Cochran was the lawyer. It was a circus. That's where all the cameras were. No one cared about what was going on at the federal courthouse.
Richard Clark, Counterterrorism Advisor, White House. In June of 2001, the intelligence community issued a warning that a major al-Qaeda terrorist attack would take place in the next many weeks. They said they were unable to find out exactly where it might take place. They said they thought it might take place in Saudi Arabia. We asked, could it take place in the United States? They said, we can't rule that out.
Abby Perkins, Special Agent, FBI Joint Terrorism Task Force. There was lots of chatter over the summer of 2001. Things were happening. People were on standby. It was a heavy summer. We thought it'd be an international attack.
Admiral Edmund Giambastiani, Senior Military Assistant, Office of the Secretary of Defense. We knew there was a higher threat level, but not where, when, or how.
Fran Townsend. John O'Neill was frustrated by the U.S.'s inability to really appreciate and get our arms around this threat in an effective way. He definitely thought we were vulnerable in the summer. He definitely felt that something was going to happen. Something important was going to happen.
Jerry Hauer, New York Director of Emergency Management, 1996 to 2000. The night of September 10th, he had said to me, "We're due, and we're due for something big." Steve Bongart, Special Agent, FBI Joint Terrorism Task Force. I remember reading that morning, on September 11, 2001, an intelligence report that bin Laden was reopening Tora Bora, his compound in Afghanistan. I was wondering, what the hell is he doing?
George Tenet, Director, CIA. The system was blinking red.
The 9/11 Commission. Time ran out.
Steve Gordon. We were in the office at 290 Broadway when the first plane hit. It sounded like the air conditioners had kicked on, a low thump, but it was late in the season for the air conditioning. We thought it was a civil aviation issue first. But we threw on our raid jackets. Maybe NYPD would need help on crowd control.
Wesley Wong. My thought was that the firemen are going to come, and they're going to put the fire out. People are going to come down the stairwells. NTSB will come in. They'll do the accident investigation. There's really nothing for the Bureau to do.
Jackie McGuire. We saw people who had obviously been hit by debris, who were bleeding. A few people sitting on the streets. A lot of people crying. Emotional.
Abby Perkins. You didn't know how far it went. I can only see what's in front of me. But we knew we were at war.
Steve Bongart. I stopped a firefighter and asked, what can we do? He said, just get people away from the building. He started to leave, then he turned back. Give me your flashlight. We're going to need extras. I gave him my mag light.
Fran Townsend. When the first plane hit, my first instinct was to call John. And I did. I didn't get through. As I was standing there on the phone, I saw the second plane. And of course, by then, there's no doubt of what the issue is. After the second plane went into the South Tower, he paged me to let me know he was okay. That was the last contact I had.
Jackie McGuire. As soon as the second plane hit, I think everyone knew what was going on.
Fred Stremmel, terrorism analyst, FBI. We knew it was terrorism, but we were in denial. It's like being told you have cancer. You want to deny it for as long as possible.
Jackie McGuire. Everyone knew right away this was most likely Al-Qaeda.
Steve Bongart. My immediate thought was, this is why they're polishing up Tora Bora.
Steve Gordon. We said, we gotta start collecting evidence. It was a combination of shock and autopilot.
Abby Perkins. Steve Gordon found a piece of the plane.
John Antisev, Special Agent, FBI. When I got there, you saw people fleeing. It was like Godzilla. I said, fucking Al-Qaeda.
Wesley Wong. I was down in the command center at the World Trade Center lobby, and John O'Neill saw me, and he came up to me. John always had his cell phone to his ear, no matter when you saw him. He was always on his cell phone. Just like that morning, the morning of 9/11, he had his cell phone. He saw me and said, Wes, what can you tell me? He had just retired from the FBI, and he was on his second day as director of security for the World Trade Center. I said to John, you're no longer with the FBI. You don't have a clearance. I can't tell you what's going on. Even under times of stress and crisis, I can be a smart aleck. He said, Wes, if you don't tell me, I'm going to wring your scrawny little neck. I told him what I knew, and he asked, I've heard that the Pentagon has been hit? I said, we're hearing that. Let me confirm. And I called headquarters. They confirmed that the Pentagon had been hit. I relayed this back to John. He said, well, I need to go check on my people in the South Tower. As he walked away, I said to him, hey, John, I owe you lunch. I missed your going away lunch. When this is all over, let's have lunch. He said something that's music to every agent's ear. He said, Wes, I'm on an expense account now. Lunch will be on me.
John O'Neill was last seen in the stairwell of the 48th floor of the South Tower.
Jackie McGuire. We heard the rumble of the first tower starting to fall. We went running.
David Kelly, Assistant U.S. Attorney, Justice Department. I was with Barry Mon, FBI Assistant Director in charge of the New York field office, and we took off running. Then we were completely buried. I couldn't breathe. It's a very fine powder. It was like being buried in a huge pile of Xerox toner. I knew I was a faster runner than Barry. I figured immediately he didn't make it.
Abby Perkins. We were hiding in a bank building. As the tower fell, I remembered how many victims in the embassy bombing in Nairobi had been hurt or killed by glass. I wanted to get away from the glass windows. I was thinking, what does it feel like to be buried in concrete? We thought we might be trapped there for a long time. My colleague, Debbie Doran, and I, we remembered Rosie, who had been rescued from the rubble in Nairobi but died of dehydration. Debbie's always organized. She's the planner of the group, and she was immediately trying to find trash cans that we could fill with water.
Steve Gordon. Then you're looking, and there's no more tower.
David Kelly. Later, I called Mary Jo White, the U.S. attorney in Manhattan. I told her Barry Mon was killed. She laughed and said, I just talked to him. He told me you were dead.
Jackie McGuire. Leads were already coming in. People were already calling into the FBI with suspicious activity they had seen.
John Miller. John O'Neill had spent the better part of 10 years fighting terrorism and the better part of 5 trying to nail bin Laden. Now Osama bin Laden had struck the 2 buildings in his care. I called O'Neill's phone all that day, hoping for a miracle.
Steve Gordon. We started walking north to 26th Street to the garage where the FBI was setting up a command post. It was devastating. The day never really ended.
We have to have evacs. Do you copy? Escaping the Pentagon. The initial rescue efforts at the Pentagon were led primarily by the military and civilian Pentagon workers, co-workers who rushed into flames and smoke to find lost, missing and injured colleagues, and follow the military's dictum of no person left behind. Nearly everyone who was rescued from the Pentagon was found in the first 30 minutes.
James Schwartz, Assistant Chief for Operations, Arlington County Fire Department. All the credit that public safety, fire, EMS, and the police departments get for their efforts on 9/11, I think what gets lost is the truly heroic efforts of the civilian and uniformed personnel that work in the Pentagon. They were the ones who really got their comrades, got their workmates out.
Captain Paul Larson, Arlington County Police Department. When I got there was probably a wall of 2,000 or 3,000 military personnel coming out of the building, and as soon as they heard the screams for help, all of them immediately turned around and went right back into the building to help whoever needed help.
Captain Charles Gibbs, Arlington County Fire Department. We were there probably within about 10 minutes. We met up with Chief Schwartz. He said, go up there. He was pointing to the impact site, which is on the heliport side, and see what's going on and let me know. I got my gear on, and me and firefighter Keith Young proceeded up there, and Fort Myer Fire Department was on the scene.
James Schwartz. Among the responding units were the crash fire rescue vehicles at National Airport, which were positioned on the West Lawn and, at that point, really were able to provide the greatest amount of extinguishment capability. There was a large fire.
John Jester, Chief, Defense Protective Service, Pentagon. The smoke was so bad you couldn't see, and the heat was so bad. There was thousands of gallons of aviation fuel on fire in the hallways.
Stephen Carter, Assistant Building Manager, Pentagon. Visibility was maybe 2 feet. There was a definite feel of heat coming through the area, but the overwhelming thing hitting my senses was the dense, acrid smoke.
Chris Combs, Special Agent FBI, Pentagon. I can remember very vividly walking through the parking lot, feeling the immense heat from that fire. At first it confused me. I was like, wow, what is burning in there? I did not know it was an airplane.
Stephen Carter. Looking up into the second and third floors, I could see people in the windows banging to get attention or to get out, but the windows were not breaking. The back wall had blown off, and it had become the only escape for some people in that area. There was a large contingent of Pentagon occupants dipping their shirts into the water that was accumulating and putting them over their faces and attempting to re-enter the building to help get people out. Staff Sergeant Christopher Brahman. As soon as I came out the stairwell, I encountered a DPS officer carrying a lady struggling with a baby. I grabbed the baby from the officer's hands. Together, we ran for about 60 yards, and I placed the baby back in the woman's arms. The woman kept saying, "Where's my baby? Where's my baby?" I realized the woman was in shock because the baby was in her arms, and she had no idea. The officer instructed me, "Go get help. Go get help." Stephen Carter. They were using the center courtyard to stage a triage area for injured people. They were putting them all around on the grass. There were medical teams that were bringing in equipment as much as possible, but there were very few supplies out there and a whole lot of people.
John Milton Brady, Jr., Safety Technician Investigator, Department of Defense. People were panicking. They didn't know which way to go. I stood there using the flashlight as a beacon and calling to the people to come toward me, and they started doing that.
Staff Sergeant Christopher Brahman. I saw this ambulance pulling up. I got to a firefighter, and it was almost like he was oblivious to what I was telling him. He was downloading all his equipment as fast as he could. I kept telling him, "I have a baby. I need help. I have a lady and a baby." All of a sudden, his eyes became fixated above me. They brought a woman from behind me who was burned from the back of her head to the back of the thighs. She was a dark-complected woman, but she was bright pink in color from the amount of burns that she received.
Lieutenant Michael Nesbitt, Defense Protective Service, Pentagon. I got a phone call, and someone said he understood that we needed helicopters. I said that was correct. He said to tell them where to go, and they would have 40 birds in the air. I said that sounded good.
Lieutenant Colonel Ted Anderson, Legislative Liaison Officer, U.S. Army, Pentagon. I kicked open a fire exit door and screamed for people to follow me. I guess there were 50, maybe 100 people who followed me out that way. I saw a field of scattered debris. It was all gray and metallic. Everybody was moving to my right, and I turned to my left and ran toward the debris. There was nobody with me except Chris Brahman.
Staff Sergeant Christopher Brahman. At that point, I met a lieutenant colonel, Ted Anderson. He's a leader in my eyes. He kept saying, "My general didn't die on my watch. My general didn't die on my watch." He'd come out and he was delirious.
Lieutenant Colonel Ted Anderson, I got as close to the building as I could, trying to find a door that we could get into. We found two women out on the ground next to the building. They had been thrown out by people who were rescuing folks inside. One woman was conscious, the other was unconscious. I picked up the conscious lady. She had a broken hip and was in horrible, horrible pain. Both had been terribly flash burned. The fire was bearing down on us. The heat was horrendous. I told her it was going to hurt, and I picked her up and threw her on my back. She screamed in pain. I ran her about 400 yards to the other side of the helipad. Chris Brahman carried the other lady. We laid them there, and other people came up to render aid. Chris and I ran back.
Staff Sergeant Christopher Brahman. There was an opening adjacent to the point of impact. We crawled through. The fireman went with us. He couldn't see anything. It was so dark that I was told they'd call it country dark.
Lieutenant Colonel Ted Anderson. Inside, we screamed for people to come toward our voices. We couldn't see anything. The smoke was billowing and it was hard to breathe. I got on the floor and felt my way down the hall. I felt a body right in front of the door. It was a woman. Extremely heavy set. She was conscious. She was bleeding from the ears and the mouth, and she was definitely in shock. She was pinned against a wall by a huge safe. It was a 6-drawer safe that had fallen and was wedged up against her. We had to try to get her out. It seemed like forever, but we were finally able to pull her free. We had to drag her from the building.
Staff Sergeant Christopher Brahman. It was so hot inside you could feel the heat. My face was burning. All I had was a t-shirt and an undershirt that I ripped off and put over my face.
Lieutenant Colonel Ted Anderson. Chris and I went back into the building and were trying to figure out what we were going to do. I noticed this bright flash that went by me. I thought it was the ceiling caving in. I heard Chris scream, "Help me." It was a person on fire trying to get out of the building.
Staff Sergeant Christopher Brahman. We jumped on top of that man and we put him out as best we could.
Lieutenant Colonel Ted Anderson. We picked him up immediately and carried him out. We got him as far away from the building as we could and gently laid him down. He was burned, horribly, horribly burned, from the top of his head all the way down to the bottom of his feet. He had no color in his eyes. They were all white. I could see it was a civilian because he had a suit on. You could see that he had a white shirt on, but the whole front had been burned away. The back of his collar was still affixed. The belt to his pants was still affixed and melted into the side of his body. Everything else was charred black down the front.
Lieutenant Colonel Rob Grunewald, Information Management Officer, U.S. Army, Pentagon. The plane came into the building and went underneath our feet, literally, by a floor. A friend of mine down the table, Martha Cardin, yelled for help, and I told Martha, "I got you, Martha, I'll come get you." Where everybody went and how they get out of the room is very unique because those are where decisions are made that are fatal or cause injury or cause mental fatigue or great consternation. A bunch of my office mates that were in that meeting went in one direction and unfortunately didn't make it. The person that sat to my left apparently went out the door and took a right, and they went into the E-ring where they apparently perished. A decision to go in one direction or another was very important.
Major James Phillips, Defense Protective Service, Pentagon. If the plane had hit any other part of the building, there would have been a lot more devastation. Ironically, the part that was hit was the newly renovated wedge.
Philip Smith, Branch Chief, U.S. Army, Pentagon. It was truly a miracle that the plane hit the strongest part of the Pentagon. It had been completely renovated to all the new anti-terrorism standards, and it was virtually unoccupied. In any other wedge of the Pentagon, there would have been 5,000 people, and the plane would have flown right through the middle of the building.
Lieutenant Colonel Rob Grunewald. As we got out of the conference room, we were into the cubicle farm. It's the typical Dilbert office space where you have tens and hundreds of cubicles in various different configurations. Four desks here, six desks here, a corridor here, a hall here, a row here, an aisle here, 20 here, copier room, fax room, enclave over here. So now, on our hands and knees, in the dark, it was trying to keep yourself oriented. Where do you go? Where is safe, and how do I get there? The plane was burning on the floor below us. As we were crawling, the floor buckled and there was flame coming up through there like a blowtorch.
Captain Darrell Oliver, Quadrennial Defense Review Office, U.S. Army. We formed up on litter teams to assist in getting others out of the building. The flames had gotten too severe for us to go back in, and the firemen directed us to stay at the door. They would bring individuals out, and we would get them to the triage area. One of the first individuals we got was severely burned on both arms. The fireman carried her to our litter and put her down. We had to position her on the stretcher, and in order to position her on a stretcher, we had to touch her. Her skin was as white as a piece of paper. As we touched her, her skin was coming off in our hands.
Lieutenant Colonel Rob Grunewald. The smoke was beginning to get very thick and was coming down further and further and further, and we were crawling on our hands and knees. You can't see where you're going, and because of the force of the blow, there were chairs thrown about, there were desks thrown about, file cabinets had fallen over, and copiers and faxes and walls. I pushed things out of the way. Martha was holding onto my belt, and we kept going. I kept crawling through the corridor into the brand new cafeteria, which wasn't even open yet because we had just moved into the renovated space. At that point, I realized that there was no more fire, there was no more smoke, and we were relatively safe. I got up, I gave Martha to some people. I said, "Martha, I'm going back inside to search for some more people." She advised against it, but I did it anyway, though I didn't get far. By that time, the smoke was down very, very close to the ground, so you couldn't see. It was quite obvious that if I was to go back in, that I would put myself in harm's way.
Sheila Denise Moody, accountant, research.